You can now hear Film Actually on Stitcher Radio. Stitcher allows you to listen to your favorite shows directly on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or WebOS device. The latest episode is always available for you. No syncing needed, no memory wasted. Don't have Stitcher? Download it for free today at Stitcher.com.
My name is Victoria Winters. My journey is beginning. A journey that I hope will open the doors of life to me and link my past with my future. A journey that will bring me to a strange and dark place. To the edge of the sea, high atop Widow's Hill. A house called Collinwood. A world I've never known, with people I've never met. People who tonight are still only shadows in my mind, but who will soon fill the days and nights of my tomorrows.
It'll be much less terrifying if you just come to me.
Wolfman's got nerves!
Make love in the hammock!
What?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Film Actually, episode 87 for the 13th of May, 2012. I am Dave McVeigh, and I am joined by Richard Gray. How are you, Richard?
I am well, David. How are you?
I'm very good. It's very weird introducing you first.
And last.
And last, because Josh is actually not with us tonight for the first time in many, 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 many moons and months.
Well, he's been doing a stoic job of keeping the show propped up in my absence, and I know it's difficult to maintain the quality of the show.
Are you not up yourself or what?
I was going to say, look, I was going to say that the show has improved since I've been on it, but I'd be lying because I never listened to the show before.
Oh, dear. This is Film Actually, the official movie podcast of geekactually.com. And Richard, it's good to have you back.
Probably.
We should explain. Josh is his lovely fiance is it's her birthday, and so we have given her Josh for a birthday present. Happy birthday, Celine! We have given her Josh as a birthday present.
We even wrapped him up in a bow.
We did.
He objected at the time,
and when he was going, we didn't listen to him at all. We just kept rapping. Okay, now that we've got that out of the way, boy, what are we doing this week, Richard? We've got two feature films to talk about. Well, actually, we have two feature films, one you're going to talk about, and the second one we're going to talk about, because I didn't get a chance to see the other one, which is a bit of a shame, but I do have some information. That film, of course, is Dark Shadows, the new Tim Burton film, and no, people, it's not that I'm trying to avoid it, it's just I didn't get time to see it, but we did also get to see the film Safe this week, the new Jason Statham film, and so we'll be reviewing that as well. You're also going to give us a rundown of what you've been up to for the last 5 weeks.
Yeah. Chronologically, this could take a while.
Abbreviated the Richard, okay. the Richard Digest version.
It's the Dick Diaries
instead of the Reader's Digest version. It's the Richard Digest version. You're going to give us because you went to a film festival while you were away, didn't you?
I did. I went to a little festival called Sundance.
Wow.
But it was Sundance London. But
so
it
it's not Sundance at all.
No, it's nowhere near Sundance. But no, it's the actual Sundance Film Festival run by the same people. Doing a program specifically designed to export to London. So it is some of the big films from that festival that will be appearing at other film festivals all throughout the year.
Fair enough indeed. And we also have a brand new list of five. Now, you're hearing right when I say this. Where our list of five this week is going to be five people who are repeating themselves.
Repeating themselves.
The idea of this list is basically we have a bunch of creative people in Hollywood, we're not saying actors or directors or anybody in particular, creative people in Hollywood who seem to just be doing the same thing nowadays, over and over and over again, as the case might be. So we will go through the five people who are repeating themselves. We should say it's probably like our top five people who are repeating themselves, but we'll just say five. That's fine. And last but not least, and I'm going to throw this one at Richard at the last second. I also, we're just going to take Richard to task on his review of The Avengers.
Which I should say, I didn't say I disliked it. But no, I threw in an extra line at the last minute, which David took exception to.
I did. And we've actually rectified all this throughout the week. But last week on the show...
A line that's no longer in the review.
That's true. Last week on the show, we said, oh, them's fighting words, we're going to put up your dukes. And of course, you've since amended all this, so it's changed. But Richard, you weren't here, and you've got to have your fair voice. What you think of the Avengers, dude?
That's all right. Now, look, I saw this in London. I've been away, as you know, for the last couple of weeks. I was in London, Paris, and Brussels. And I went to see a very early morning session of this in a big cinema in Leicester Square. And it was the first possible session I could see that was available for sale. because I'd miss all advanced screenings here in Australia. I was suitably impressed, but there was a bit of me that was feeling somewhat underwhelmed, and I still have a few of the issues with it that I have on a second viewing, which is a very elongated first act, which is possibly unnecessary for a series that has had five films setting it up. And I do feel as though there is a certain point where I kind of just get a little overwhelmed in all the action at the end. And I think that's why it's kind of requires a second viewing.
Or a third in my case.
or a third viewing in your case, absolutely. And you're certainly probably one of the fanboys who've seen it the least.
That's true.
Three times. My theory is it's the same 10 people have seen it 80 times each that accounts for the box office. I think it's an outstanding film. It is, as Kevin Feige called it this morning, it's a milestone.
So who's that?
Is it Kevin Feige? Kevin Feige? Kevin F.
Now, Kevin, if you're out there and would like to actually give us the proper pronunciation of your name, please write to us at feedback@filmactually.com.
So the Marvel Studios head.
The boss.
He actually referred to it as a milestone and not necessarily a destination. So this is just basically a flag being planted in the middle of the Marvel Universe saying, this is what we've been building up to, but we're kind of not there yet. We've still got more to go.
You know what this is? It was a flag being planted in the sand, them saying, geeks assemble!
Geeks assemble. And look, you know, one issue I would have with the film is that it does spend a lot of time setting up other films, which it's great for geeks and fanboys, not so good as a standalone narrative. Because I think one of the things with the Avengers is it's got a standalone by itself as well, and not just, you know, being dead.
And this is where I had to take up arms with you, because I think you're nuts.
But having said that, on a second viewing, I do actually think that it is an incredibly strong and tight paced film, and I think for me it was just that initial gut reaction, having seen it after all that anticipation building up to it, and needing that second viewing to actually digest it.
And so Richard came back and we saw it together, and there was a line in your review, which is the line we took exception to, where you said, you know, great. I think it was something along the lines of,
I said, highly recommended. Look, I have a little rating system. I don't do stars.
Right.
And I said, highly recommended was my rating, which I stand by. For fans.
Let's get clear. You said highly recommended for fanboys.
And I said, I think better than the average bear for everybody else. Now.
And then I said, but my assessment is, I think this is highly recommended for everyone, because if there was ever proof that this was a mass market film, we've got it in its box office.
And I agree for the most part. And I absolutely agree for the most part. That's just why I've modified it. And on a second viewing, I can actually see it. There's just little subtleties for the dialogue. And, you know, I don't often change reviews. I don't often rewrite. In the case of Inception, I actually wrote a completely second review upon seeing it a second and third time.
Really? I didn't see that. Did you like it better or worse?
I liked it better. And I wrote it for DVD Bits, my old site, which is not there anymore. I actually modified it and actually started. I still had some problems with that film. But I actually, on a second viewing, I appreciated kind of where Inception sits in the pantheon of films.
It's actually one of the reasons why I really love doing this show, Because I really love doing this show for two major reasons. A, it's my chance to get together with my buds and geek out. But more importantly, I love the fact that we get to see all the screenings and so forth, and we actually get time to mull it over before we record. Because we often have almost like a week between these films before we actually have to record the show. And you get to think about it. Whereas when I write reviews, you're tending to see a film, come home, throw your words down on paper. You know,
it's a gut reaction. And it's exactly what it is. And
yeah.
I will admit that, and I'll cop to that. And I think, I wrote little notes on a little thing that I have here. I'm quite anal about it. But I gave Avengers a solid 4 out of 5 the first time I saw it. On my second viewing, I gave it a 4.5, borderline 5.
Yes, yeah. Power to the geeks.
So I think it is a film that will grow on you. And it's kind of like, I think it needs that because there is so much happening in the Avengers.
Absolutely.
That you do need a second viewing to digest it. Which
and
is
everybody I know is seeing it 2 and 3 times, which is why it's got the box office, obviously.
You know, absolutely. And I think that, you know, maybe that's a fault in that you have to see it a second time to catch everything. But no, I think the best films you do need to see several times. Quite handily, I think it's gone from that first viewing where I needed time to think about it to the second viewing where I've actually it's kind of shifted its way into my top 10 for the year sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So,
my lovely wife Katie actually even said to me she would like to see the film again, and she doesn't often see things twice.
No,
so
I mean, I'd see it a third time at the stage. You know, so.
Yeah, I'd see it a fourth time.
Fair enough.
I really like it. Anyway, we should move on. I just wanted to allow you to get that chance because you weren't here for the Avengers show. And
No. Like, I like being insulted in my absence.
And considering that we'd had 2 years of build up to this, and then for you not to be here the day it comes out.
It's so funny. It was actually ironic because we all met on Thor.
I know, exactly.
And it was kind of like we'd gone through Thor and we'd gone through Captain America and then all the lead up together, and we've been talking about this on panels and on this show.
And then you disappeared.
Yeah. I had to have a holiday, man. I needed it.
That's fair enough. So we had to at least get your opinions on the record. No, we actually weren't insulting you too much. Your review was actually very fair. It was that little assessment at the end where you were talking about the fanboys. I went, no, this is actually not a fanboy film.
I may have been a little provocative at that point.
Yeah, just a little bit, but that's okay. That's okay. Yeah. And, you know, everybody's entitled to their opinion. You were just wrong. But look, Richard, when I want your opinion, I'll give it to you. All right.
That I can rely on. Yeah.
Oh, I'm terrible. I'm so tired. I shouldn't be doing a show when I'm this tired. It's like driving drunk. All right. Richard, I want to, before we get into some film reviews, we normally do a what you've been watching in Josh's Bargain Basement and all that sort of stuff, but Josh isn't here, so there's no Bargain Basement. Wait a minute. I better just have a quick listen. Hold on. No, he's definitely not there. All right, so... All right, so what we're going to do is in the what we've been watching section, we're going to be doing something slightly different. I want you just to run down Sundance with us and some of the highlights that you saw.
Yeah, look, I saw 5 films. Well, actually, it was 5.5 films because 2 days in New York, they had a problem with the print when it looked really good. I saw a couple of films. So I saw one called Nobody Walks, which is by a young filmmaker. Her name is... Rai Russo Young.
Right.
And she's made a couple of films previously. She co-wrote this one with Lena Dunham, who I knew from a previous film called Tiny Furniture, which I saw at Melbourne International Film Festival last year. The rest of the world will probably know her from a brand new TV series on HBO called Girls,
right?
Which she stars in and is one of the creators of. So it's kind of got it's very much about isolation in Los Angeles. Kind of the effect. It's got and I always mispronounce this guy's name. And I'm gonna have to go back and look his name up. Just forget it. Look up the movie. it's because otherwise I'll spend forever talking about this. Oh, sorry, it's John Krasinski. There you go. I don't mispronounce his name at all.
Oh, okay.
It's got John Krasinski, Olivia Thirlby, and the wonderful Rosemary DeWitt in it. It's basically about this couple who are fairly open in the relationship, and they take in this this young 20-something filmmaker into their house because John Krasinski plays a sound designer. And basically the wife's so, you know, forgiving that she lets, you know, this 20-something hot girl into a soundproof room with her husband for, you know, weeks on end. and, you know, obviously – things happen as a result of that. So it is an interesting character study. It's got a little bit of wank to it, but I think it's a really strong film, and it's a really good independent voice. So a couple of other films, a movie called Love, it's spelled L-U-V. This one's by a filmmaker named Sheldon Candace, and it stars rapper Common, who a lot of people have seen recently in the AMC series Hell on Wheels.
He's been getting a bit of profile lately, hasn't he?
Getting a huge profile, but it's also, this movie's also got Danny Glover and Charles S. Dutton in it, in an excellent role from Danny Glover, but it's also got a young boy in his first role called, and his name's Michael Rainey Jr., and he's excellent. And it's kind of like a cross between, it's like a Junior Training Day in a way, because it's, but it's also being compared to The Wire. It's set on the main streets of Baltimore.
Right.
And it's about this Common plays this uncle who decides his boy needs some learning and takes him out on needs to tough him up as a man, basically, and takes him out to see his business dealings with him. But it all goes kind of wrong, and he sort of learns to become an adult, you know, in the worst possible way. And it's a very powerful little film. And just quickly, there are three other films I saw, but I'll mention the names of two of them, but I want to highlight one of them in particular.
Okay. Yep.
I saw Liberal Arts, which is by a movie by Josh Radnor, who's the who plays Ted Mosby on How I Met Your Mother.
Right, I like him.
And it's the actor. It's his second film as a writer director, and it's excellent. It's a really it's quite a light thing. It's probably got one of Zac Efron's best roles in ages. He plays this kind of stoner
character. Zac Efron's best roles?
Yeah, okay. It is Zac Efron's best role. He's only in it for about 5 minutes. So
and that's the best part of the role.
I saw another film called For Ellen, which has an excellent performance by Paul Dano in it. And that's well worth checking out. That film and the previous one I mentioned, Liberal Arts, are both turning up at the Sydney Film Festival. So check those out when they come to Australia. But the closing night film of the Sydney Film Festival and my personal favourite pick from Sundance London was Safety Not Guaranteed.
Right.
Which is, you'll probably remember a internet meme from a few years ago about that ad that was in the papers. Required somebody to go back in time with me. This is not a joke. You'll get paid after
that's
get back.
Right, that's
must
right.
Bring your own weapon. Safety not guaranteed. I've only done this once before. So what they've done is basically built this sort of comedy drama around that concept. These reporters have gone to investigate who this guy is and is he for real and what's going on. And it stars Aubrey Plaza, who people might know for Parks and Recreation,
mm-hmm.
Jake M. Johnson, who's in New Girl on television,
right?
And Mark Duplass, who's a filmmaker in his own right, but he also plays Kenneth, who's the guy that put the ad in the paper. And it's just, it's one of those films. I heard the filmmaker talk, Colin Trevorrow. He was talking after the film, and he was saying he was inspired by those Amblin films of the 80s, where you kind of like something magical was possibly happening, but you didn't really know until the final frame of the film, really. And, you know, when those miraculous things happen, like, you know, when E.T. or, you know, Close Encounters or something, but you don't, it may not happen. It could just be the rantings of a madman, but you want to believe. And that's what's so magical about this film. It just kind of, you can't help yourself but get so wrapped up in this story.
You kind of had me when you said he was a fan of the Amblin films in the 80s.
So that was a huge highlight for me from Sundance. And then two other films, I'll just quickly mention that I've seen them because bragging rights, Cabin in the Woods. I managed to see that in London.
I'm dying to see Cabin in the Woods.
Which is, to me, it's kind of the logical progression. Evil Dead 2 for the 80s, Scream for the 90s, Cabin in the Woods for our era that we're in at the moment, the 2010s. I don't know if there was one.
They don't work, do they? The tens.
No, the tens. I want to mention that really quickly simply because, and the reason I make that comparison is because I think there'll be a lot of copycat films, a lot of films trying to be the next Cabin in the Woods come out. This is the year of Joss Whedon.
It is.
This is basically if he'd had the budget and the clout back in the 90s when he was making Buffy, this would have been the greatest Buffy movie ever made. You know, it's that kind of.
I'm dying to see it. It's getting it's getting a brief limited run here soon.
In June.
Yeah, I really want to see it.
Yeah, and that's going to be around the country now. Roadshow have actually come to the party on that. Lastly, very quickly, I saw Twixt, which is Francis Ford Coppola's latest film.
You saw it?
I saw Twixt, and it was it is a trip, let me tell you. I actually really liked it. I think it's visually stunning. I think it's really interesting, and it's kind of interesting that in his later years he's become the experimental filmmaker that he always kind of planned to be in his early career before he got sidetracked with, you know, big blockbusters like The Godfather.
So when does it happen for George Lucas?
Because
remember, he was originally wanted to be a little art house indie director who did experimental films, and he got caught up in the whole Star Wars world.
Well, that's right.
So when does he go back to it now?
Well, I don't know. Let's hope he does. It's just really interesting that, and look, you know, it doesn't always work, but it is very funny. It's kind of like somewhere between Twin Peaks and Sin City. You know, it's just,
oh my God.
Like, you know, visually it's got that kind of Sin City to it. Thematically it's Twin Peaks. It's just, it's really interesting, like, that he's done this, you know, very late in his career. And this, and I think between that and his previous film, Tetro, which didn't get released here, he is actually accepted festivals. He suddenly become this kind of avant-garde filmmaker.
And before that, he had, what was it, Young for Young or whatever it was called?
Oh, yeah. Youth,
that's right, yeah.
That got almost universally panned, but it was another experimental film. So yeah. he is really, really trying to do new and fresh things, and I salute him for it. And in this case, I might be one of the few people who says so, but I think he's accomplished.
Oh no, Margaret Pomeranz is with you.
Okay,
when that youth, what's it called again? Youth,
Youth Without Youth.
Youth Without Youth came out. I remember she actually said that it was obviously the work of a master filmmaker, and that's when David Stratton turned to her and went, "Really, Margaret?"
I mean, look, we've got to remember Francis Ford Coppola is someone who, in his career, is responsible for over the 33 films or the 33 titles that he's directed. He has done, just quickly, The Godfather, The Conversation, The Godfather Part 2, Apocalypse Now,
Tucker the Man in His Dream, Peggy Sue Got Married, Rumblefish, The Outsiders.
And those first couple of ones that I mentioned were all back-to-back.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, he this is a guy who did The Godfather, Conversation, Godfather Part 2, and Apocalypse Now, back to back.
Yeah, and then, you know, and then followed all that up with Places from the Heart.
Yeah.
Not Places from the Heart. One from the Heart.
He also directed the Captain EO short for Michael Jackson.
He did too. That's right. Look, I am an unabashed Francis Ford Coppola fan, so don't get me wrong.
But it's been, you know, I think we'd have to go back as far as The Rainmaker before his last, you know, memorable film.
Yeah, look, he, for those who don't know, Coppola actually drove himself into the ground. He actually tried it two films in a row. The second time failed, which was to bank everything he had on a production. He did it for Apocalypse Now, drove himself to the point of bankruptcy, and then the film was a hit, and he made his money back. And then he did the same thing again a couple years later with One from the Heart, and it failed, and he lost everything. He was actually in debt, millions of dollars, and he became, for a period of a decade and a half, a director for hire, because he literally was paying off a debt. And he did, but arguably some really great films in that period of time. This is when he did Peggy Sue Got Married and Rumblefish and The Outsiders and Gardens of Stone and Tucker the Man and His Machine. Tucker the Man and His Machine is fantastic.
Yeah.
Really like Tucker. So he did some really good stuff. And the last film of his debt paying off was Godfather Part 3.
Which, if it wasn't a Godfather film, would be a superior gangster.
Exactly. If there had been no Godfathers before, you would have looked at it and gone, it's a masterpiece. But the problem is that the first two Godfathers are so good that Godfather 3 just pales in comparison. Mm. And now that he's paid off his debt, he's now become this experimental filmmaker, as you say. And he's been doing very odd and interesting work. And I don't think it all works. But I give him full credit for trying. He also did the Bram Stoker Dracula, which was like a very expensive art film, which didn't work very well. But, you know, it was a vision. I don't know if it was the right vision, but it was a vision. I find him fascinating as a filmmaker. I find everything about him fascinating, actually.
Look, Twixt hasn't even got a US release date. I saw it because it came out in France. And so
this was the film that at one point, he actually did a screening of it in the States. I read an article about it where he actually had footage on his iPad, and he was, as it was projecting, he was re-editing the film.
Yep.
And so it was like a live performance.
Right? And he was saying that, you know, you could do this in every session. The other thing that he did, which annoyed a lot of people at its original screening, was that there was two 3D sections originally, which in the print that I saw he's taken out. But he actually projected 3D glasses onto the screen saying, put them on now.
Oh, my God.
Sort of thing. And it was kind of like really kitschy and stuff. It's like the man hadn't seen a 3D film in, you know, 30
years. Yeah, yeah. So I'm not saying everything works that he does, but I actually really want to see Twix. I saw the trailer for it and I went, what the hell is this?
Well, as I said, it's out in Europe. It came out on the 11th of April in France, and I actually saw it the day of release. It came out in Russia a couple of weeks later, and Sweden, it's coming out on DVD next month, but there's no other release dates. It doesn't have a US release date, doesn't have an Australian release date.
Time to go online shopping, I think.
Yeah.
And see if I can find a copy of that Swedish DVD.
Yes. Yeah. So look for that late next month.
damn straight. Okay. So is that it?
Although there's more, but I think that'll cover it.
That'll do for now. We're halfway through a show. That'll do for now. Let's get on to some film reviews. All right. So first up, now, I didn't get a chance to see this. I was actually scheduled to go to the screening, and I actually had to work, so I couldn't get to it. And I was actually a bit sad because I actually did want to see it. However, now that I've heard from you and Josh, maybe I was making the right decision. But anyway, the film is Dark Shadows, the 2012 reimagining of the television series from the 60s and 70s. This is directed by Tim Burton, written by Seth Graham Greene, who, if you know that name, is actually the person who wrote Pride and Prejudice and Zombies and Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, but yeah. He's not done any... film work before, which is, it kind of shows.
Right, and it's also written, the story is written by John August and I believe Tim Burton and a couple of others. They're written off the top. I'm reading off of IMDb here right now. I was based on a series by Dan Curtis, a story by John August and Seth Graham Smith. Now, it stars, are we ready? Now, speaking of things that repeat themselves, Tim Burton has cast Johnny Depp, Michelle Pfeiffer, Helena Bonham Carter, Eva Green, Jackie Earle Haley, Johnny Lee Miller, Chloe Grace Moretz, Christopher Lee, Alice Cooper. Anybody else I've forgotten here?
Did you mention Bella Heathcote?
Oh, no, Bella Heathcote. Sorry. She's
kind of important to the film.
Okay, Bella Heathcote. I was actually going through these as the people who Tim Burton seems to work with an awful lot.
Right, yeah, no, it's after true. And music by Danny Elfman.
And music by Danny Elfman, of course. Okay, so with all that, and I've also got just a little bit of... Before you go into your review, I was just reading before the show a little bit about the original Dark Shadows. Because I don't think you've ever seen it, have you?
No, I haven't.
Okay, so you've never seen the original Dark Shadows. My memories of the original series of Dark Shadows are faint. I do remember it from being a child, but it's an awful long time ago, okay? I don't think Dark Shadows ever made much of an impression outside of the United States. I think it was just an afternoon soap opera, daytime soap opera that just happened to have a vampire in it, which was just an odd concept. It started in the 1960s. It was from ABC. Now, it actually ran for 1,225 episodes.
Wow.
It is the... It has more single episodes than most other science fiction fantasy films of its time, including Doctor Who and the entire Star Trek television franchise. Only the paranormal soap opera Passions has more episodes with 2,200.
Oh, I remember Passions.
Yeah, Passions was much later, 2,231 episodes. Now, apparently Tim Burton, Quentin Tarantino, and Madonna have all stated that they're huge fans of this series and so forth. So this was a big thing. All right, this was a soap opera. And it was very interesting because I was looking at it going, Dan Curtis, I know this name Dan Curtis, who is the creator of the series. So I went and looked up Dan Curtis, and no wonder his name seemed familiar to me. You remember the Night Stalker TV series, don't you? Kolchak, he created
Kolchak,
that.
Yeah.
He created that. He also created The House of Dark Shadows. He created Burnt Offerings, the movie. He remember the television movie with Karen Black, Trilogy of Terror, with the little Zumi doll?
Yeah.
That's one of his. He also created the epic miniseries, The Winds of War and War and Remembrance, in the 80s. So this guy had pedigree.
And interesting connection is that... Johnny Depp is soon to star in a new adaptation of The Night Stalker,
Yes, he is.
Which will be directed by Edgar Wright.
That's right. I forgot about that. So there you go. So there's Dan Curtis. Okay. He liked the word night, and he liked the word, because I'm looking at his thing.
Dark.
He liked the words night, dark, and house, because if you look at his films, he's got House of Dark Shadows, Night of Dark Shadows, wait for it, hold on, Curse of the Black Widow, Dead of Night. It's like, these are all things that he's produced. And you go, he liked those words. Anyway, all right, so with all that being said, the opening clip from the show, as you heard, was actually the intro to the original first episode of the series.
Yes.
So... now, with all that being said, Tim Burton has come on. He's directed it. Let's have a quick look at the trailer, and then I want to hear what you thought of Tim Burton's take on this series.
All right.
All right.
My name is Barnabas Collins. 2 centuries ago, I made Collinwood my home.
My love.
Until a jealous witch cursed me, condemning me to the shadows.
What have you done?
For all time.
What the hell is this?
He's coming. He's coming.
Hear me, future dweller. What is the year?
1972.
1972. Ah. My beloved Collinwood.
The Collins family.
Who the hell is this?
I'm a vampire, madam.
Yeah.
He's not staying with us forever, is he?
I like him.
Oh, super fat.
Welcome home, Barnabas Collins.
How soon can the horses be ready?
We don't have horses. We have a Chevy.
I'm on the top of... what sorcery is this?
Reveal yourself, tiny songstress.
Hello, Barnabas. Remember me?
Witch.
You cursed me to be this hideous creature.
You may strategically place your wonderful lips upon my posterior and kiss it repeatedly.
What if I made you love me?
With what a spell?
With this.
I must admit, they have not aged a day.
She for real?
Indeed.
You and your family.
Missed me. I shall restore the family business to its former glory.
Burn, baby. Burn.
Fight on, Barnabas. Fight on for us.
And fight I shall.
Love me.
Never. Was a regrettable turn of events.
Are you stoned or something?
They tried stoning me, my dear. It did not work.
All right, Richard. That doesn't sound like a dramatic soap opera.
No, it's not. And it really isn't. I mean, look, first things first. When did we lose Johnny Depp? Because it seems that like the last 4 or 5 films he's been in have been terrible. Or not so good. I mean, I think starting with the disappointing Public Enemies,
right?
Which I think was a bit of a misguided effort from Michael Mann.
Oh, very. We shredded it on this show. I hated it.
Yeah, and I didn't like it either. And you know, cash grabs of The Tourist, the misguided, basically embarrassing Alice in Wonderland, made a lot of money.
But whereas I actually didn't mind The Tourist. I thought it's not a great film, don't get me wrong, but I thought it was kind of, you know, amusingly fun. But I agree with you about Alice. I hated Alice in Wonderland.
Alice was terrible. It made a lot of money, but it was a terrible film. It was embarrassing for Johnny Depp. Pirates of the Caribbean on Stranger Tides is basically the same, you know, kind of soaked person he's been. Exactly. And then he also did The Rum Diary, which was kind of a return to the similar
Fear
character
and Loathing, yeah.
Fear and Loathing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's another retread.
It's another retread, but he he's sort of been playing Jack Sparrow. He is Jack Sparrow now. So in this film, I mean, Tim Burton himself has actually developed certain gothic sameness to his last few films and maybe his last 10 films. Even when he was experimenting with like the CGI heavy Alice in Wonderland or the musical Sweeney Todd, they kind of looked the same. I mean, while I do salute a filmmaker who has got a definite voice and a definite vision, there's a thin line between signature and retread.
Yeah, and this all comes back to a long time ago in Geek Actually. We talked to, we played that Funny or Die video, which was Tim Burton coming up with his next film, and it was like the board meeting. I don't know if you ever saw that, where it's like he's got all his usual people around. He goes, we got to come up with a new film. And the guy goes, what have we got in costumes? She goes, I've got more spiral colored pants. He goes, excellent. We'll use those. He goes, Danny, what have you got? And he goes, oompa, oompa, oompa. He goes, excellent. Your best work yet. He goes, get my wife on the phone. And the mobile phone gets pulled out, and it just has two buttons on it. Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter. It's actually a very funny video. If you go online, you can find it. It's his little meeting about, you know, and like, what's he say at one point? He says, you know, how are we going to paint, you know, how, what are we going to do with this film? And under their breath, the cinematographer's going, yeah, what's new?
Now, the thing about this film is that it should work, because the high concept is actually quite good. I mean, it's a vampire has returned from the grave after 200 years. You know, trying to get his family back together, and there's a hot witch after him. You know, I mean, that, you know, kind of...
And a hot witch she is indeed. We got Eva Green.
Mm. Eva Green is, and look, she's one of the best thing about it, and for two good reasons. But the problem is that a lot of the script, and this is Seth Graham Smith's script, invests a lot of time in Depp's performance. So it focuses, it's a very Depp-centric film.
And yet what's funny is when they first talked about this film, they said it wasn't going to be a Johnny Depp film. It was going to be an ensemble piece and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, bullshit.
And you know, certainly not. And most of the time spent around his, you know, fish out of water gags. You know, what is this demon songstress in this small box and all those kind of things. And you know, I mean, the original series, a lot of the popularity of that came from the introduction of Barnum's Colin. So
yeah, in fact, I actually happen to have right here, funny you should mention that, I happen to have here the introduction of Barnabas Collins. And I'm only going to play a very, very small part. It's actually on YouTube, and it's a minute and a half long, but I'm just going to play this a little bit because I think this is probably the most iconic part.
Oh, madam, if you would, you may tell her that it's Barnabas Collins.
Gotta love the dramatic music that comes with that.
What I think it's is like that in the theater. It's like, madam, it's Barnabas Collins.
And I've come in from Singapore.
Yeah. Like, you know, and that kind of Johnny Depp stuff carries about the first quarter of the film, but it's still a little bit dull. But then the rest of it kind of plays out either like a greatest hits package of both the original series and of Burton's previous work. I mean, you've kind of got, you know, the suitably baddie Helena Bonham Carter. Her role is kind of purely perfunctory, but she's just Helena Bonham Carter in a different wig. You know, really isn't. Chloe Moretz is woeful in this. Like, she's really bad.
Oh,
and,
dear.
There's a reveal at the end, which I won't spoil here. Maybe if we do a spoilers section later,
I don't think we're going to bother with a spoiler section this week.
There's no spoiler section later. Look, should I spoil it?
Spoil it. Go on. Nobody's going to see this movie anyway. Here. All right. If you don't want to hear a spoiler, fast forward 8 seconds.
Basically, she's revealed to be a werewolf with a line. So I'm a werewolf. Get over it.
Towards
the end. And really, it does nothing, that reveal. It's just there, and it's not really expanded upon afterwards. They don't do anything. It's just they needed an extra little bit of quirk in there. Now, Eva Green brings some life to this because she's really hot in it.
She's hot in everything.
She's really hot in everything, but she's particularly – I could be mistaken.
And in the TV series Camelot, she's hot and naked. You know, so.
There you go. But I could be wrong, but he looks like he's trying to sculpt her into his former muse, Lisa Marie. but she's the only one who brings any life to it. I mean, look, it's basically aping other films in this kind of misguided attempt at retro charm. It kind of sets it in the 70s and tries to do retro 70s, but it just kind of comes off as just a retread. And, you know, and case in point is the fact that there's an extended sequence with Alice Cooper playing live at their party that they're having. I mean, my long story short is, he's gotten everybody that he's ever worked with, you know, back together again for this film, and it's no surprise because that he's getting back onto family turf, because he's already got his next two films, a Frankenweenie.
A remake of his own work, yeah. A
remake of his own work, and Beetlejuice 2.
A sequel to his own work.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, he has definitely just given up and just decided, I'm not even going to pretend. Like, with this film, he's he's redoing what he's done before, but he's not even pretending from this point onwards. And honestly, I can't recommend this to anybody. I found it boring as hell.
Well, that's very, very sad. But I'm not surprised from that trailer.
But happy at the same time. Because it saves you all money.
Well, that's true. And look, the trailer, I remember we saw the trailer for the first time at one of the mini screenings we've been to, and we kind of just went, oh, dear. You know, it's like it wasn't a wonderful feeling of like, oh, doesn't that look fantastic? It was kind of like, really? Are we doing this again? And it hadn't even been done before. We just feel like we're doing it again because it's just, yeah. So no, I can appreciate that. I probably will still end up going to see it just as a matter of, I should.
Morbid curiosity.
Well, morbid curiosity, and I should, because you know me, I see everything. But you know, I try and see everything. I'm even going to get the Tree of Life at some point.
Yeah,
I am going to get the Tree of Life at some point. Trust me.
I'm going to strap you down, Clockwork Orange style.
I almost bought it on Blu-ray the other day, dude. I was holding it in my hand, and then I went, too much like homework.
And I put it back. Every time I'm holding it in my hand, I think it's too much like homework.
Do you actually want to add the Tree of Life to the beginning of that sentence?
Yeah. No, I know. I know what I was doing with that gag.
Okay, cool. All right, fair enough. All right, let's move on to a second feature film, and this one we can do together.
Is it safe?
It is. I can see the joke starting already. Okay, so the second film we saw was the 2012 film Safe, written and directed by, now, how do you pronounce his name? Is it Boaz?
I've been going with Boaz.
Boaz Yakin. Yakin.
Maybe Yakin?
Bose, Yakin, whatever. Anyway.
He's got an interesting pedigree, let me tell you.
All right, well, you look up his pedigree for me while I finish this part, and then you can tell me. Jason Statham, Catherine Chan, Chris Sarandon, James Hong, favorite of mine, let me just tell you. I love James Hong. We're noodle folk. I love him. No, I think
I made your eyes.
And I don't think there's anybody else in this cast that we care about, is there?
No,
not really. Okay.
Oh, did we mention Chris Sarandon?
Yeah, I said him at the beginning.
Okay, well, there you go. Then we've mentioned everyone.
Then we mentioned everybody with a note. Okay, so May, a young girl whose memory holds a priceless numerical code, finds herself pursued
Which
by the...
Which is stupid, by the way, but go on.
Yeah, finds herself pursued by the triads, the Russian mob, and corrupt NYC cops. Of course, because they all have to come out and play. Coming to her aid is an ex-cage fighter whose life is destroyed by the gangsters on May's trail. Mm. Trail. Thank you. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that was trail. Sometimes words just don't look right.
No.
All right. So
sometimes films don't look right.
Well, and that would be in this case. All right. What's the pedigree of Boaz Yakin?
Well, he actually, as I said at the start of my review on my side, if the name looks familiar, you probably need to watch a better class of film. because he goes back to the late 80s, in fact.
I know the name. So,
which is where this film exists for the most part.
Pretty much.
He wrote the Dolph Lundgren Punisher.
Oh, my God. He did. I'm looking at it right now.
He also wrote The Rookie, and then he made his directorial debut with a movie called Fresh, which wasn't so bad, in 1994. But he also wrote things like a lot of direct-to-video sequels, like From Dusk Till Dawn 2, Texas Blood Money. Dirty Dancing, Havana Nights.
Oh, my God.
But he also wrote the to be fair, underrated Prince of Persia.
No, not underrated at all, dude.
I quite liked it. But anyway.
I thought it was pretty average. But anyway, that we'll agree to disagree. But yes, no, the name was familiar when I saw him, and I went, I know that name. But it was actually The Punisher and The Rookie I was thinking of. There you go.
It's also, this might be interesting for our other show, Behind the Panels. He's written a graphic novel called Marathon, which came out this year.
We will look for that. All right. We will definitely look for that. Okay, so yes, I think you hit the nail on the head with this film. It feels absolutely stuck in the 80s.
Yeah, and if you weren't sure, it's got James Hong in it. So, who it's from, you know, Blade Runner and Big Trouble in Little China. He was kind of like, for years, he was like, if you look back through James
Hong.
No,
that's one of his lines in Big Trouble in Little China. He goes, ah!
If you look back.
Not now, Mr. Button!
If you look back through James Hong credit, and I think we should do a tribute to James Hong at some stage.
I think we should. I think he's fantastic. Although you do a tribute when they die, dude. He's still alive.
Yeah, I know, but it's dramatic. He's a legend. He's he's in so many TV series where he's just sort of turned up, and you know the role that he's played in that. that him seeing the show, you know there's a token role that they've got him to play. He seems to relish in it, but here he gets to play a bit of a mob boss. He's a great character actor, awesome guy.
Can I invite everybody to go to IMDb, and I think you should do this right now, Richard. Go to IMDb and look up Boaz Yakin. Just to look at the picture that he has on his profile.
I'm sure I did this earlier in the week, but I'll refresh my
memory. Have a look at it. And everybody out there, you should go to IMDb and have a look. Is this not the most, oh me, oh my.
I'll just stand here in the corner until someone notices me.
Did anybody like my last movie? That's a terrible picture to put on your IMDb profile. Anyway, sorry to get sidetracked.
And he's just wearing sweats. He's just giving up.
This is just a completely defeated picture. It's amazing. All right, let's watch this trailer for Safe and come back and talk about this film. Here it comes. Oh, do we have to? All right, here it comes.
In the New York City underworld, there are gangsters, killers, and corrupt cops. But today, the most wanted person in the city is a 12-year-old girl.
You want to tell me why those men are after you?
I can memorize anything. They showed me a very long number.
Is there anything interesting to you about these numbers?
It's not just random. There's a sequence.
It's a code. Help me
if you can. Who took the girl?
It was Luke Wright.
What?
Luke Wright, the Big Apple's hardest cop, once upon a time.
Get everybody on this.
The Chinese and the Russians.
Close every exit out of Manhattan.
That girl does not leave this city.
Let's go to war.
Are we safe?
Till my dying day.
I got the numbers. Now you're dealing with me.
Hold on.
You got some balls, Luke.
Yeah, amazing. I can even walk.
Safe.
Я никогда не знаю, что говорит в такие моменты.
Какие моменты?
Перед тем, как я кого-то.
All right, so as we were saying before that, this is a film that is completely rooted in the 80s. And I said to you when I came out, I didn't hate it, but this is a film...
You're right, you didn't even need to say the 80s. It's just completely rooted.
This is a film where I basically... And look, I should stress just for the fact that we do usually have a third co-host. Josh actually quite liked this film. And we'll let him defend it next week. Right?
He's not here to defend it. Let's get it.
Let's get him.
Hold it down. You beat it.
I didn't hate this film, but I said to you, I said, this is a sort of film that in the 80s, when you used to go to the video libraries, and we're talking about VHS people, you know, when you used to go and get your VHS movies out and you get your 5-for-10 special for a drunken Saturday night, this would be in that collection.
It's very much of a relic of that era. It's like Jason Statham is actually one of the last action heroes in a lot of ways.
He is. He is the Chuck Norris, the Steven Seagal, etc. of this era.
He's like a relic of an era that treated its kind of muscle men as gods, and before it sort of unceremoniously dumped them direct to DVD, you know, and video in the mid 90s. Onwards, you know, and you know, the Expendables being an exception, of course. But the whole movie is like that. It's kind of got this view of New York, which is kind of stuck in the 70s or 80s.
And it's funny you bring up the Expendables, because the Expendables is not a good movie. All right,
but it
knows exactly what it is. And against all better judgment, I actually really enjoyed it, because it is just completely saying, "Look at all of us. We used to be action stars." And we're having fun blowing crap up. You know what I mean? And I really enjoyed that. I actually said to Josh and Celine, because we saw it together, and Celine didn't like it very much. Celine just thought they all looked old. You know what I mean? And I just said, you know, this is sort of film, you know, maybe it's a guy thing. Maybe it's because I was an action film fan of the 80s. That this is sort of film that I would go out and buy on Blu-ray. You know what I mean? And have in the closet for those nights where you go, I just want to see shit blow up, you know?
Let's see. Well, I think it's telling that Jason Statham is in both Expendables.
Exactly. The problem with Safe is that Safe doesn't have that knowing wink to the camera. It doesn't have the old people in it basically saying, look, we all used to be action stars. It's taking itself seriously.
It takes itself very seriously. And the thing is, as I said, it's got that old school kind of New York that never actually existed except in the movies.
Or in Kings of New York.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like, but you know, there's a few good fist fights and car chases, but they're few and far between. Most of this is just laughable dialogue, kind of really cliched, setups. It's got, you know, we've got crooked cops, we've got corrupt officials, we've got the Russian mafia, we've got the triad, we've got, you know, an ex cop slash boxer who's trying to do good with his life, but he's on kind of a Charles Bronson-esque mission. Because he's white.
But it even has all those wonderful cliches, like you don't know. He's a cage fighter, right? Yeah. And he's a fighter who obviously, the spoilers, people, he's supposed to have thrown a fight. He didn't throw the fight because the other guy was a wimp and, you know, got killed, right? And of course, the excuse is, well, he shouldn't have been in the ring with me. Not I should have gone lighter on him, but he shouldn't have been in the ring with me. And then, of course, as it goes on, of course, it turns out he used to be a super cop.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we have to throw in that extra cliche. It's not good enough that he's just a great fighter. No, he also used to be a super cop. You know?
It's kind of like Boaz Yakin's gone through his VHS collection and gone, I'll have a bit of that, I'll have a bit of that.
You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me of, not Simon Pegg, Nick Frost. It reminds me of Nick Frost's character in Hot Fuzz. His closet with all the films.
Yeah, that was exactly it. And that was, of course, a parody. This is, as you say, taking itself very, very, very seriously.
And it comes from really flawed concepts because you're right. The concept that this girl had this photographic memory and recorded this list of numbers in her head. Right. Okay. Crap right there. And I call bull crap on that right there. Right.
Absolutely.
But.
The background to that, and I have to, because I want to call bullshit on this whole thing. The background of this is that. In China, like all the gangs are set up in New York.
Okay, let's start with this. Yeah.
But in China, there was a girl that they'd noticed who was really clever at maths. So they kidnapped her from China, flew her over to the US where she was set up because clearly she was the smartest kid in the world. They did this. They got an 11-year-old girl from China to do this rather than maybe finding a genius kid in New York.
And this was based purely on the fact that she could remember how to put back the abacus.
Yeah, absolutely.
There were no other tests to this, you notice. She put
no other tests. She could put back the abacus. Therefore, she was trusted with all of the mob secrets.
All right, so that's flawed concept right there. But I also have problems with the fact that this Jason Statham's character is so browbeaten.
Sorry, can I mention that they flew her over from China before she even did the abacus test?
That's true.
Because one of her friends at school
said she's smart. Clever. Yeah, that's right. They didn't even have to. They didn't even actually go to the school and actually test this theory. They just took the other girl's, word for it. Anyway, and for some reason, this guy who is so downbeat that everybody, and mind you, everybody around him that he even talks to seems to get killed. But he sees her on
killed themselves.
Sorry.
Maybe they just killed themselves.
Maybe they said, I can't stand you. It's like the character in Flying High. Every time he starts to tell his story, they commit suicide. Anyway, he's about to throw himself in front of a train, and he sees the girl on the platform, and for some reason decides to save her. And this is
I think he sees the guys going after
her. No, he doesn't see them. He just sees her. And that's the part. And then it's after that he sees the guys get into the train and stuff like that. But he's already stepping back from the platform watching her. And so you sit there and go, it's a very odd thing that would catch his eye.
Mm.
And I just had real – it's almost like they said, how do we get them hooked together? And they go, maybe she could run into him or something. They go, oh, no, that's too cliched. Maybe he could just see her from afar.
And be fascinated by this little 11-year-old girl.
Which in itself is vaguely disturbing.
Yeah.
And then it goes on from there with violence, violence, more violence and violence, which is actually, Josh said when he was talking to me about it, he said he loved it because it was just such a downright violent action film. And it was.
And I know a lot of people I spoke to kind of liked the completely laughable dialogue. They liked the kind of, you know, when they're sort of like, you know, you got the biggest balls, man. He goes, yeah, surprised I can even walk. Yeah,
best line in the film, by the way.
Yeah. And things like, oh, what was it? There was another line in there where he says, I'm going to do things to you that will make it difficult for me to look at myself in the mirror. Yeah. He was saying that to the bad guys, not the girl.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, that would be even worse, wouldn't it?
Yeah. But it is a bad film in the sense that, but I think we might have on our hands an unintentional cult hit in the same way that Abduction was.
And look, this is video rental fodder.
Oh, it is. It's
and
a rental
and if you rented it and you took it out and you put it in your DVD player, or your Blu-ray player, you'll probably have a great time with it if you don't take it too seriously. It's just stupid.
Agreed.
But it is definitely not something that I'm going to recommend that you go out and pour big old cinema dollars onto, because it really isn't. It doesn't. Although, that being said, it was shot in 2.35 widescreen scope, which even the Avengers couldn't seem to do.
It looked pretty good when it looked good.
It did. No, and look, and the film was actually nicely shot, and the action scenes are actually quite tightly shot, and, you know, Statham knows how to kick ass. We've established that. He knows how to kick ass, and he looks great on camera. And I like Statham. He's always Statham.
Yeah.
I don't think he's done anything different since Transporter 1.
Never. No.
No, because, I mean, even before that, he was kind of interesting. When he did things like, you know, Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and stuff, he was interesting. But since doing Transporter, I don't think he's done anything different.
No, not at all.
Yeah, and this isn't the film that's breaking that mold. Oh, no, actually, there was one. I think I quite liked him. What was the heist film he did?
Oh, The Bank Job?
The Bank Job. I quite liked The Bank Job.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the only stray from formula for him in the last few years. But look, you know, I'm going to say wait for video.
Yeah. No, I would agree with you. I'd say wait for video and rent it.
Yeah, absolutely. Don't buy it. Rent it. Yeah. And if we had Netflix streaming, stream it for free.
No, absolutely.
So there you go.
But don't BitTorrent it, because don't risk potential imprisonment over this film.
No, it's not worth it. All right. I think we've flogged that horse enough, don't you?
Done and dusted. List of five, David. Let's move on.
All right, list of five. This week's list of five, because of the esteemed Mr. Depp and the esteemed Mr. Statham, it got Richard thinking, because Richard came up with this list, which I love, of five people who are repeating themselves. So I thought, what a good idea. But I thought, let's not limit this to actors. Let's limit this to entertainment people, of creative people who just seem to be repeating themselves a little bit too often. And we're going to start with you, Richard. What is your number five?
Okay, the first one is kind of related, and you might disagree, but we've already made the joke already, which is Danny Elfman.
No, I agree with you. I think Danny Elfman, he used to be one of my favorites, and I will say that he is actually a little higher on my list, so I'll come back to him. Please give me, because my Danny Elfman's slightly different to yours, I think.
Right, well, I mean, look, he has more or less written the same score for the last few films. Don't get me wrong, this guy is an actual, you know, musical genius. He has done some amazing stuff.
And he is, I mean, he is quite a legend for his early work. I mean,
go on. I mean, look, no, he did the Simpsons theme.
So yeah, well, there you go. But there's also the Beetlejuice theme and Batman. And I mean, I still stand by that. I think the score for Midnight Run is actually a brilliant score, and very different for him.
Yeah.
But you're right. The last few films, it all starts to merge together.
And let's not forget Nightmare Before Christmas as well.
Yes.
Mm. But yeah, we've made the joke before. It's kind of been pretty much, if you hear,
now what is it? Oompa, 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 oompa.
You know, if you hear that on a soundtrack, chances are Danny Elfman was involved.
Did I ever tell you the quick anecdote? I think I have, but I'll say it again anyway because it's fun. Mark Isham, who scored the Addams Family movie, when he was approached to do the Addams Family movie, the first words out of his mouth were, "What, is Danny Elfman busy?" So I always thought that was very charming. That's actually on the liner notes to the album.
Nice.
All right, my number five is actually a power couple.
Ooh, get it?
It's got to be Tony Scott and Denzel Washington.
Of course.
I mean, let's face it; they have been making the same film for the last decade.
Agreed.
So I think the two of them need to just have some time out and separate and do something different for a while. Although my question is, with their relationship, will Denzel Washington be in Top Gun 2?
I wonder, yeah. He'll feel the need for speed.
Maybe he'll be one of the commandants of the camp, you know?
No, I think he'd have to be. Yeah. He had to give him a high rank after he's earned it.
Yeah, he can't be a fighter pilot. He's too old, too.
Yeah, exactly.
You're on number four.
Number four is a difficult one because I do actually like the guy, and it's not an excuse for me to do an impersonation, but it's Owen Wilson.
Oh, yes.
He's pretty much been playing like...
Do your impersonation. Done, like, you know you want to.
He's done some interesting things. He's been in things like Darjeeling Limited, and he was a voice in Fantastic Mr. Fox, and recently the wonderful Midnight in Paris.
Fantastic film.
But he is, in all other films, pretty much Owen Wilson. And we're talking things like, you know, in Cars 2, it's Owen Wilson as a car. You know, in Hall Pass, in Little Fockers, in, you know, Night at the Museum 2.
I hated Hall Pass.
In Drillbit Taylor, in Marley and Me. They're all, and these, that's just the last, you know, 4 years.
Yeah, and I think we should make this very clear that just because they're repeating themselves doesn't mean we hate them.
No, and I think, but he has, it is Owen Wilson's persona. I think he really, and I think that was what I liked about Midnight in Paris so much, is it was a brief break for him. He was still Owen Wilson, but there was a little bit of Woody Allen in there as well, naturally.
Yeah. Well, he was his analog, so...
He was his analog, but I think what Owen Wilson needs is a better class of role. Mm. But he keeps taking these rom-coms and these really bad comedies where all he has to do is sit there the whole time and go, hey, we're doing something exciting, you know, it's great. That's all he does, you know, and that's literally his character that he just transplants into a new set of dialogue, you know.
Yeah, so, yeah, no, agree.
That's what I'm saying. But I still enjoy most Owen Wilson films, so...
Agreed. A person who I don't enjoy most of his films, but there have been a couple that I do like, but I do think that he is getting incredibly tedious, has got to be Adam Sandler at my number
absolutely.
Four.
Yeah.
I think Adam Sandler has become incredibly tedious, and every time I see a poster for a new Adam Sandler film, I go, oh, God, again. So, now he's got to be my number four. And, I mean, there's been a couple of Adam Sandlers I've liked. I didn't mind Click, but, God, when he fails big time. Being said, I'd rather see any Adam Sandler film over The Dictator, but that's a whole different story. Listen to Film Actually News. Mm-hmm. All right, your number three.
Have you done your number three yet?
Adam Sandler.
Oh, you did it. Oh, so that was actually your
answer. That was my number four, was Adam Sandler.
There you go. My number three, actually, from The Dictator, leads us straight into Sacha Baron Cohen.
Yes.
So I feel as though he has actually... As we said in Film Actually News, I feel as though he's done the racist man with facial hair several times now.
Mm-hmm.
And this most recent film, The Dictator, proves that he is just putting on a beard as an excuse to be as bigoted as he likes on screen. In other roles he's done recently, Hugo, for example, I thought he was one of the weaker links in the film. The film is so brilliant that it transcends him.
Yep.
But he does bring that character to it. He even basically he has the two roles. He has his racist character that he does. So either Ali G, Barat, Bruno, or the dictator,
or the cartoon character,
or the cartoon character, which he did in Hugo, and he also did in Sweeney Todd
and Talladega Nights.
Yeah, yeah. That kind of one as well. But I mean, I think the one in Sweeney Todd and the one in Hugo were almost the same character.
Hmm.
And it's really, really disappointing for someone who clearly does have a talent for comedy to just be sort of squandering it on his own eccentricities. Really.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I agree. All right, less said on him, the better. At this point, I'm very mad at him right now. Number three for me has got to be, and once again, this is not a fact that I hate him. I actually really quite enjoy him, but I got to say Liam Neeson, who hasn't done anything different, and I think I can pinpoint the time, too. I think it's when his wife died. I think he's been working through some sort of demon, and he's played the same role almost every year for... that entire time now.
And I think we might have said this when we were reviewing The Grey.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's working out some demons, and he plays these dark, embittered men. And he plays the same character with the same bad American accent.
He has a very particular
set. He has a very particular set of accents that he can do. And he does. And I quite enjoy Liam Neeson. I quite enjoy seeing him on screen, and I like his presence. And he wasn't, you know, I mean, he was quite good in The Gray. I didn't like the ending of The Gray, as we've talked about, but, you know, he was quite good in The Gray. Mm. And I quite like him, and I really like Taken. There's a visceral thing about Taken that I really like. But he's not stretching as an actor.
No.
He's just doing the same thing over and over and over again.
Exactly, which probably leads me nicely into my number two.
All right, your number two is?
My number two. Oh.
Oh, my God. He's my number two as well.
Hooah.
Hooah. I actually sat there, Richard, and tonight, and I said, one of the masters of cinema basically goes on this list because they're all doing the same thing at this point. And I said, am I going to put De Niro, Pacino, or Jack Nicholson on this list? And I said, because they're all basically doing themselves over and over and over again now. They've gotten to a point in their lives where they don't have to try too hard anymore. You know what I mean? But I came to the conclusion, and I'm wondering if you came to this conclusion as well, where Al Pacino has not done anything new since Scent of a Woman.
No, that's exactly the point that I cut it off at. Scent of a Woman is where he decided that he would no longer be playing Carlito or Grandpa or Lieutenant Vincent Hanna or Mayor John Pappas. He would be playing Al Pacino.
Al Pacino, exactly right.
from that point onwards. In fact, in Jack and Jill, an Adam Sandler film, he plays Al Pacino.
And I think it's because with Scent of a Woman, he finally won his Oscar and he went, this is what they want me to play.
He went, oh, what an Oscar. Yeah, I can stop acting now.
So I'm right there with you. My number two is Al Pacino as well. And I love Al Pacino. But he really...
We mentioned Francis Ford Coppola before, and he was in The Godfather, but he was also in films like Serpico and The Brilliant Dog Day Afternoon and all these wonderful films of the 70s and 80s. And as you say, early 90s, it just stops.
Yeah, no, it stops. And you can pinpoint it right down to Scent of a Woman. That is the film, because his persona has frozen into that persona.
Now, let's not be wrong. There have been good performances in that time. There are things like Heat, which is still excellent.
He was good in Insomnia as well.
He was in Insomnia, which is good to a lesser extent. The Insider.
Yes.
I kind of found him fun in Devil's Advocate as well.
Absolutely.
And he did a documentary in there called Looking for Richard, which
great
is Richard
documentary. Once again, playing himself.
Playing himself. But he's done some interesting stuff, is my point, in that time. But he has kind of stood still from a performance point of view.
Yeah. And look, we enjoy watching him play himself. But he has done nothing.
Gino was still better than good, you know.
Exactly. And like with me,
actually, good Adam Sandler. Something like when he's with a good director, like Paul Thomas Anderson, in something like Punch Drunk Love.
Yeah, absolutely.
He's really good.
Yes, but he's still just doing Adam Sandler. Anyway, and like when I was looking at it, I was going, you know, saying Jack Nicholson really hasn't played anything other than himself either. But then there's these little moments where, like, he'll do something like About Schmidt, and you go, he's actually stretched a little bit. Or you go, he's actually turned around and is making fun of himself in more recent films like Meet the Fockers, you know, making fun of his own persona. And you sit there and go, so there is still some spark of life still left in there, you know, whereas Al Pacino has just stopped.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, he has just stopped. All right, so that's both of our number twos.
Yep.
So you're number one.
Number one is, again, a person who I actually enjoy his work, but this is probably a bit of a controversial selection. It's Quentin Tarantino. Not because I feel as though he's made the same film repeatedly, but he's got a definite shtick that he does.
Yep.
Which is, each time he comes to a film, it's like, right, what genre am I going to rip off this time?
Yeah.
And now there's been some very good films that have come out of this. I really enjoyed Inglourious Basterds.
Mm-hmm.
Kill Bill, I really enjoyed the first one, and I enjoy the second one more. But now with Django Unchained being announced, it's kind of like, well, okay, like he did his tribute to crime films with City on Fire. He did his his kind of, he did his Pulp Fiction film with Pulp Fiction. Yep. You know, he did, he's done his vampire film in there. He's done, which he did with Robert Rodriguez, of yep. course. You know, he did his tribute to Asian cinema, which he loves. He did his tribute to Westerns with Kill Bill Part Two.
And with Inglourious Bastards. That whole opening sequence is a spaghetti Western.
And, of course, films of the 1940s and war films as well. And now he's doing Westerns again, which you could argue he's been influenced by all along. But it just does seem that the whole approach to this film and all of its stuff that we've seen so far seems to be coming from a point where, you know, I got a whole bunch of movies I like, okay? And what I'm going to do is, you know, I really like that scene, okay, in Sergio Leone, right? You know, and all that stuff. And it's kind of like you can see the cogs turning where he's kind of like going, yep, I like those films and I'm going to somehow work those into a narrative of my own film.
I actually said this to, Josh many episodes ago, where I said, I'm still waiting for Tarantino to do something original.
Yeah.
And that's not to say I don't like his films. I think Tarantino is fantastic and I love his films, but
he clearly loves cinema,
but they are all, every one of his films in a form is just a tribute to another film.
And there's a very fine line between tribute and ripping off.
Yeah. And I'm waiting for the day that he actually makes a fully original where he finds his voice and not everybody else's voice.
And Inglourious Basterds was almost that, but I just don't think I've seen all the references that to the 1940s films that he's referencing.
Yeah, and I mean, as soon as I saw that opening shot, I went, oh my God, this is a spaghetti Western. And, you know, there were so many factors, but I loved Inglourious Basterds. And I actually think that Django Unchained is just going to be a tribute to Sergio Leone. So I don't think it's going to be this one.
And Spaghetti Western. I agree with you. And I think he's taken a big backward step with Django Unchained.
So I am still waiting for him to have his voice. And I haven't seen that yet, but I love his films. Don't get me wrong. I adore him. But
I could question whether he has a voice yet, because he is still that video store clerk who is trying to prove to everyone how much he knows about movies.
Yeah, and when he took a really long break from cinema, because he actually took a very long break before he did Inglourious Basterds, I was kind of hoping that was kind of a growing period for him. When Inglourious Basterds came out, I was hoping it was going to be something really fresh, and it wasn't. It was kind of just what he does.
Well, I can't remember who said this to me, and it could have been you, but it could have been someone else as well, that Django Unchained is the last film that we've been hearing about for years.
No, you told me this. Yeah, this is
fascinating. Yeah, that's right. I think I heard this from some colleagues in Melbourne. Yeah. That Django Unchained is the last film that's been kicking around in development that we know about. You know, we know about most projects.
That
we know of. So anything that comes this, he's starting from scratch now. He doesn't have anything else on the boil that we know of. So hopefully the film after this will be the big original film. But I've just heard that, you know, somebody else left, I think, I can't remember which actor this year, someone's left Django Unchained this week.
Did you see the stills that came out?
I did see the stills that
came out. They look pretty good, though. I mean, it's got a good look to it. All right, my number one is actually a family. Remember, I started this list with a power couple. I thought I'd finish this list with a power family. And the power family has to be Tim Burton, Johnny Depp, Helena Bonham Carter, and Danny Elfman, who have made basically the same film for the last 5 years in a row.
I can't argue with that. And this is kind of where we came to with this list, because Dark Shadows really, really inspired this. And I mentioned Danny Elfman on there because I thought, well, we're going to be talking about those actors and those directors a lot. But when you look back at the list, of the 28 films that Tim Burton's directed, from about Edward Scissorhands onwards, he's more or less made the same film. We were talking, with the exception of the Batman films that are in there as well, Edward Scissorhands, Edward sort of stands by itself.
Oh, but you could add Batman Returns in there, because Batman Returns is very much a Tim Burton film.
Edward kind of stands on its own thing.
Yep, and to a degree, so does Mars Attacks.
And so does Mars Attacks. But if you look at Edward Scissorhands, Batman Returns, Sleepy Hollow, even Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, Corpse Bride, Sweeney Todd, Alice in Wonderland, Dark Shadows, and the soon-to-come Frankenweenie, he is definitely retreading.
Yeah, and the problem is he's taking them all along for the ride.
Yeah.
So it's become this. It's become almost a joke. You go, it's a Tim Burton film. Oh, right. That means Johnny Depp's in it. That means Helena Bonham Carter's in it. That means Danny Elfman's going to score. That means, you know, and you know the formula. And you can almost say it's almost kind of sad because you say his cogwheels must be, oh, I'm going to make this new film. Just open the Rolodex. Yeah. It's like start making phone calls. They're all there.
Yeah, he's not the first filmmaker in history to have that kind of roster. No. Of regular people.
And I got to say, you just rattled off that row of films. I actually like a lot of those movies.
Yeah.
It's actually his most recent films that has started to annoy me. Up until Alice in Wonderland, I would still give him time.
Yeah, look, Sweeney Todd, I think there's a lot to love about it, but it's Alice in Wonderland. I know with Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, I was divided because I think there's a lot to like in that film, but it was feeling a bit
same. It walked a fine line. Yeah, it walked a very fine line. I enjoyed it. I was on the right side of that line, but I could see the line.
And Corpse Bride was good, but it was a lesser Nightmare Before Elm
Street. Oh, I'm watching Corpse Bride was good, but it was no Henry Selick.
Nightmare Before Christmas, I bet to call it Elm Street.
Yeah, it was no Henry Selick. And Henry Selick was the heart behind Nightmare Before Christmas. And we found that out by Coraline.
Yes.
Which was just so good, you know?
No, brilliant film.
And so you know where the heart of that film came from. Tim Burton was the look. Henry Selick was the heart, you know, and you can actually see it a little bit in, I mean, because Tim Burton also produced James and the Giant Peach, which I actually wasn't as fond of.
No. I think it's a deeply flawed film.
Yeah, and it's almost like you can see that's one of the reasons why they may not be working together now.
No, in fact, Selick's joined with Pixar and Walt Disney Company for a long term contract to exclusively produce stop motion films.
Fantastic. And I actually heard something today which I do not know is true. And if anybody out there knows if this is true, I would love to hear some insider gossip. But I actually heard today that Corpse Bride was actually not stop motion. It was made to look like a stop motion film, but it's actually CG.
I think I've heard that too. And there's also another bit of news that I'll look that up. But I think there's another bit of news that I heard was, that's right, Neil Gaiman's Graveyard Book is being adapted by Disney, and Selick's going to direct that.
I want to see it.
So yeah, so he's basically he Coraline was Neil Gaiman as well.
Yeah,
so.
Coraline was fabulous. I just loved it. Now I have a future watch. You know how normally we have an honorary mention.
Mm-hmm.
I have a future watch on mine. Something to look for in the future. I think I've got one that will be, if we ever did this list again in a few years, I have one for that list. And that's going to be James Cameron for going into the Avatar business.
Oh, look, you know, I almost put him on here just for that. it was, he's going to be making Avatar 2, 3, 4. If he sticks to his plan, all it takes is for Avatar 2 or 3 to be a financial disaster.
Yeah.
Because you know what's going to happen. He's going to be given more money than God for Avatar 2.
Yeah.
Because the first one made $2 billion. Yeah. I mean, you know, Avengers cost $200 million to make. Maybe it was $230 million.
220 for Avengers.
And it made it back. How much did
the budget?
Avatar cost a lot of money. The thing is with Cameron, he throws a lot of money at films. I think Titanic was the most expensive film ever made at the time.
Yes.
And so was Avatar, I believe.
And so was Terminator 2, and so was True Lies.
They've all, but the gamble's paid off in every case because he knows how to make an action film.
Yeah.
But he's getting older, and the fact that he's saying that he's only going to be making these films is indicative that his creative instincts might be.
He's also a little distracted now. He's distracted by being an adventurer.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the thing. He's not as focused on his film career as he was when he was doing films like Titanic. And
if you want to draw a parallel to George Lucas, you're starting to see someone who's more interested in the technical side of filmmaking than creating stories.
That's exactly right. So, and I think James Cameron is due for a fall. And it's not that I want to see anybody fall, but he's due for a fall.
No, and I remember back when we did a list of people that we'd follow anywhere. Mm. Actually, I don't think I was there for that week, but you mentioned, I think, James Cameron as one of your people because you were always interested in what came next.
Yeah.
But now that we know what's going to come next for the
next
three films.
I'm not so interested.
Exactly.
No, Cameron, these lists are fluid. They change all the time, and that list would obviously change now. Because he's actually, I look at him now and I go, you're not interesting anymore. You've annoyed me. You know what I mean? Anyway, we should probably wrap up. That's our list for this week. I thought that was actually quite amusing.
No, that was fun.
That was fun. If you want to write to us, offer your opinions on films, chastise us, or suggest a list, send your emails to feedback@filmactually.com. You should be aware that we do two other shows, which are the Film Actually News Show and Behind the Panels, the comic podcast, comic book podcast. It's not comic, like you know, what's the deal with this?
We should do one of those.
We should. No, the comic book podcast, you can find them all on iTunes or here, right here on geekactually.com. Richard, where can people find out more about you on the internet?
They can find me at those two other shows you mentioned, along with therealbits.com, that's REELbits.com, and on Twitter at DVDBits.
Fantastic. And Josh is normally on this show with us, but Josh isn't here today, as we said at the beginning. But you can find out more about Josh at hiphopnetonline.com. Is that right?
That sounds about right.
Wow, fantastic. And rawdlc.com, his two other sites. You can also find me at geekactually.com or on Twitter at David McVeigh. And now, Richard, before we go, what is our campaign on Twitter?
Our campaign on Twitter, what we basically want to see happen is a marathon of all the Marvel films in one of the big cinemas, either Event or Hoyt Cinemas. We think that people want to use the hashtag MarvelMarathonAU.
Yep.
And start getting a campaign and direct your tweets at Event Cinemas or Hoyts Australia. They're both on Twitter. They've both got their accounts listed on their website. So we want to see this happen. We want to see all six Marvel films played in a marathon session at some stage, hopefully in the next couple of months. It's only a 12.5-hour
session. And
then
I want everyone to come. And we'll all have a big party. We'll have a big party there.
And as we said on Behind the Panels, if there's a charity organization who wants to get behind this and maybe use it as a means of raising awareness of a cause, even better. Unless it's a cause we don't agree with.
Absolutely. But speaking of causes, the one cause you should all believe in is we're trying to raise money to go to Comic-Con, because we are accredited to go to Comic-Con, and we've got it right on the front page of geekactually.com. We are trying to raise money, so throw a couple of bucks our way. It might help us out, get interviews. We know that Stan Lee is going to be at this thing, and we are damn sure going to try and get an interview with this man. Because he's marvelous.
He's marvelous, Dave.
Thank you. I can't do his voice. You can. It's fantastic.
No. It's marvelous, Dave. Marvelous. Excelsior.
All right. So we're trying to get there. And both Richard and I are currently running competitions to win copies of Teen Wolf Season 1. So you can go to either of our sites and you get double the chance to win.
And I'm running a bunch of competitions, by the way. So if you just go to my website, look for the featured section on the front, you'll see all of those competitions there.
And now that we've finished flogging all of our stuff, Real Junkies is
another... Let's flog somebody else.
Let's flog somebody else's stuff. Real Junkies is another podcast. They do movie reviews like us, but they like to drink tequila while they're doing it. They're a lot of fun. They just reviewed The Avengers, so go check out their podcast right now. I just had like a marathon of their stuff and listened to a whole bunch because I'd fallen behind. Boys, I'm sorry I fell behind, but I've listened to them all now. go out and check them out. You can find them at weekendronin.com or on iTunes, REEL, like your website, Richard. Real Junkies is the name of that podcast. And
you can
also
get a Real Bits as well, if you like.
You can get a Real Bits too if you want to. That's kind of cool. I'm too tired to flog anything else. I think that's all I've got.
I'm going to leave it alone.
I told you I shouldn't be doing this show when I'm this tired. It's like drink driving.
Do what you feel and put both feet on the wheel. You can't go. Don't have to go home, but you can stay here. Till next time.
What is it in the movie Summer School, which funnily enough was also scored by Danny Elfman? No, the film Summer School, when he goes, fact, the reason people have accidents when they drink and drive is because they're not taught to drive when they're drunk. I love that. Alright, everybody out there, go see more movies. You don't see enough movies, and all of life's questions are answered in the movies, and we'll see you all again next week. Richard, I'll see you next week.
See you then, man.
Bye, dude.